Try to not be too very late. We're continuing on with Senate Bill 5530, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and welcome Ms. Gregory back. And let's see, please pick it up from where we dropped it off yesterday. As I think we were finishing up with finished merchandising and regulatory, I believe, but please start back up, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yesterday we completed our agency overview, but what we'd like to do this morning is to have Merle Lindsay have a discussion with you regarding revenue and then move on into the merchandising and regulatory programs as a more in-depth view of those.
And before you move into merchandising, we'll have Satish do his overview of the governor's budget, and then we'll start with that.
Okay. Yeah, we missed Satish yesterday because of, and I beg your pardon, we missed Satish because of the conflicts that he had, an important man in several places of the building. So, Mr. Padilla, would you like to take it from there, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We start with Merle first? Okay.
I mean with
Chairman
on revenues.
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson. For the record, I'm Merle Lindsay, Director of Administrative Services Division.
Sorry.
And if you'll turn in your presentation book to the revenue tab, that's where we are starting this morning. I'm very pleased to be able to report to you this morning that even during these difficult economic times, the Liquor Commission continues in its role as another fund's revenue producer for the state of Oregon, supporting the general fund, cities, counties, mental health, and as you heard yesterday, the Wine Advisory Board. The Commission is forecasting that total gross revenues for the 03-05 biennium will reach almost $593 million. This morning, I'm going to give you an overview of the sources of those revenues and distribution of our profits. On page one of your book,
I saw you now.
You'll see that the Liquor Commission generates revenue from three main sources: liquor sales, privilege taxes, and license fees. Of these three sources, the liquor revenues provide the majority of our revenues. Almost 95% of our gross income will come from the sale of distilled spirits sold through our 238 stores. Liquor is just a little bit different than from our privilege taxes, which are located in statute, as well as our license fees. The Liquor Commission is responsible for establishing the retail price of the products. When we looked at our 0305 forecast, we assumed that consumption would remain flat at 1.3 gallons per person. You saw the consumption graph yesterday. It had leveled out at about 1.3 gallons per person. We assumed that our supplier price inflation would be about 2% per year, and that population growth in the state would be modest during the biennium. This all translates into a $561 million liquor forecast. On page two, you'll see that our second largest source of revenue comes from the collection of our privilege taxes. Now, this is a tax on the beer and wine that's manufactured or imported in the state of Oregon. You can see that we have over 480 licensees who hold various types of privileges, such as wholesalers, breweries, brew pubs, and wineries. The tax rates on these products are set in statute in Chapter 473. Beer is taxed at $2.60 per barrel, or 31 gallons, but let me put that into a package size that the consumer would see on the shelf. That translates into less than 1 cent per 12-ounce bottle of beer. Our table wine, which is wine that's 14% and under, is taxed at 67 cents per gallon, and that equates to about 13.3 cents for a 750-milliliter bottle of wine, a standard-sized bottle of wine. And then the wine that's over 14% is taxed at 77 cents a gallon, and that is about 15.3 cents per bottle. We are anticipating that per capita consumption will remain flat in this area. We expect to collect about $25 million in tax revenues during the biennium, and we finally will collect about $5.9 million from our license fees. If you turn to the next page, I'm going to explain how our monthly...
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson?
Just so I understand, the Wine Advisory Board and the 2 cents per gallon that goes to the Wine Advisory Board, could you give us a little background on the creation of the Wine Advisory Board and what that money's used for?
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, that goes back to, I believe, 1983 when that was established. And what was created in statute was that 2 cents of all wine taxes collected went to the Wine Advisory Board for promotion to do promotion research of Oregon wines.
I'm just speculating, Mr. Chair. Given now the burgeoning growth of brew pubs and microbreweries that are specific to the Northwest and are garnering quite a reputation, the seeming inequity that there's a wine advisory board, not a beer advisory board, and wondering how much the activities of the wine advisory board could be paid for by the wine industry, thereby freeing up that $300,000 for other purposes.
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, I've not heard any discussion about the wine board paying for any sort of beer promotion at this point in time.
I think that misses the point. That is, if the $300,000 was removed from the wine advisory, could within the wine industry, table wine industry in Oregon, could they go ahead and provide for their own advisory and their own? I think that's where you're
That's exactly where I'm headed. I'm thinking in the 20 years since 1983, that's an industry that has matured to international reputation. And a proliferation of wineries throughout Oregon that are doing quite well and successful. And I'm just wondering about, as we're being asked to scour budgets, perhaps there's something I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, in 1982, I think it was, the Wine Advisory Board was created by the legislature, and the 2 cents was designated and agreed to by the wine industry.
Director Lang, for the record.
Okay, for the record. My name is Philip Lang. I'm chairman of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The industry agreed to the 2 cents at that time. Most of the money that goes to taxation that we receive from the taxation on wine isn't from the Oregon wineries. Most of the money comes from the California wineries. In fact, there's sort of a joke among the wine industry that it's an Ernest and Julio tax, and they're the ones that are really paying for the Wine Advisory Board. I think that any attempt to try and divert that $300,000 away would really create a problem as far as the wine industry is concerned.
Well, respectfully, Mr. Chair, I think that is all some of us are trying to do is to take the advice of the co-chairs very carefully to continue to scour budgets to look for opportunities. Obviously, I don't know a great deal of the history of the genesis of the tax, and that's the reason for my query.
And an excellent query at that, Representative Johnson, because I guess I hadn't even considered that it's on all table wines, and consequently would probably hit outside Oregon more than it would hit the Oregon producers. However, as you say, there's an industry which has come a long ways in the last 20 to 30 years. So. And again, it's $300,000+ per biennium, is that right?
Chairman Butler, it's correct. I think about $366,000 is what we're forecasting.
For the next biennium?
For the next biennium.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'd like you to discuss how our monthly distribution works. Each month we close our books and distribute the excess cash as required by law. You can see from this bubble chart here where the three sources of our revenue are up on top. But let me walk you down the right-hand side of the page first, because the beer and wine tax is a little bit different than our license fees and liquor. First off, 2 cents of all wine taxes collected goes to the Wine Advisory Board. From that balance, we take 50% and it's distributed to the mental health, drug, and alcohol account. And then the remaining 50% merges into a single cash bucket, which includes our liquor and license fees. From there, we pay our expenses. Our largest portion of our costs goes towards paying our private sector liquor suppliers and freight companies. From there, we pay our agents' comp to our 238 contractors located in the state. And finally, we pay the agency operating costs, which includes the regulatory, merchandising, and support services program. Now, the percentages at the bottom, the distribution, they are set in statute, with 56% going to the general fund, 34% to cities, and 10% to counties. On the next page, we'll show the beneficiary of these profits. You can see in graph format that we are anticipating that the general fund will receive $119 million in distribution, or its 56% share. Cities should receive $72 million, counties $21 million, and the mental health, drug, and alcohol account about $13 million, or half the beer and wine taxes collected, for a total distribution of $226 million during the biennium. We looked at this $119 million worth of general fund distribution. We looked at the governor's balanced budget and found that these dollars would be enough to fund the following agencies: the legislative branch at $55.6 million, Office of the Governor at $7.4 million, Secretary of State at $11.2 million, and in addition, you could also fund the State Library, the Criminal Justice Commission, the Military Department, Department of Housing and Community Services, and the State Fair.
Let me ask a question coming back to the graph, if I may, please, Mr. Menzies. Presently, there's a preemption from cities and counties taxing alcohol.
Chairman Butler, that's correct.
And that preemption is statutory at this particular point.
Chairman Butler, that's correct as well.
When in Special Session 6 to balance the 0103 budget, when the legislature took a portion of the funds that were available, it took nothing that belonged to cities and local governments. Is that right?
That's correct, Chairman.
But it did take it did go in and take that portion which would normally be spread under this distribution chart that you've got to the agents.
That's correct as well.
What was the dollar amount that agents were deficient as a result of that taking in the final quarter?
Chairman Butler, if we were to reach our $530 million forecast, it would be approximately $450,000 short of adequate compensation to maintain the 8.54%.
So the taking to balance the general fund budget for the state is approximately $450,000 from the agents then?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Potentially.
Right. Assuming that all of the criteria are met. Okay, thank you.
I guess one last point that I'd just like to make this morning is that in addition to our direct beneficiaries, the general fund cities and counties, others such as our private liquor suppliers, our freight companies, and our 238 liquor agents benefit financially from the operations of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. With that, I'll conclude my presentation and be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Lindsay regarding revenue portion of the side of the budget? Senator Winters is recognized.
Thank you. I just wanted to know, what are the percentages that go to the cities and counties? Do you have the dollar amount? Can you give me the percentages?
Okay. The cities receive approximately, well, they receive 34%, and the counties will receive 10%. And then the bottom half of this distribution is the mental health, drug, and alcohol. They receive half of the beer and wine taxes, and about $13 million is what we're projecting for next biennium.
And the cities, there is no specific designation as to the use of those dollars, do you know?
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, no, there's not.
But the counties, there is, isn't there? There's no specifics for the county either, so neither one. So, okay. So only our little piece that's the 13 to mental health is alcohol and drug-related emphasis.
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, that's correct.
I think those were originally designated that those monies went to cities and counties for enforcement of drug-related issues, and they do participate certainly in the enforcement operation in conjunction with the OLCC and other sting operations from time to time that are involved. I guess I'd like to come back to the preemption issue. If cities and counties could tax, and assuming that they came to an agreement amongst the leagues and associations, and assuming that that preemption went away, could the Liquor Control Commission, would there be additional cost to collect, for instance, if that tax, current tax, which is around 83 hundredths of a cent per 12-ounce serving, if cities and counties were passed a 10-cent per 12-ounce serving, could that be collected by the OLCC, and would that cost any additional to collect and distribute it as opposed to the 83 hundredths of a cent?
Chairman Butler, I don't believe so. I think that would be just a change on our tax form for the collection of that money. And then the distribution, there's no additional work in the distribution.
But if it were an irregular, that is one county over another, then that would create more accounting.
Chairman Butler, that would be correct. There would need additional staff time to be able to reconcile all of the dollars.
Okay. Are there any further questions relative to the revenue? Let's proceed. Satish, are you ready to go ahead and review the governor's balanced budget with us?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be talking to you about the governor's budget for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the 2003-2005 biennium. And you also have copies of my presentation document in front of you. If you will turn to page 2, the recommended budget consists of $83.5 million total funds. This is a 6.2% increase from the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget to the 5th special session. And if you will look at the pie chart on page 3, you will see that the agency's entire budget is other funds. Merle just now talked about the different revenue sources. Those, I mean, the liquor sales, business taxes on malt beverages and wine, the licensing fees, and other miscellaneous fees and income. The agency has a small amount of the non-limited expenditure limitation, and this is for the cost of processing credit card transactions.
What kind of transactions?
Credit card.
Oh, okay.
Costly credit card.
I think Senator Winters has a question about credit card transactions and the cost of them. Still a question coming.
What is the cost of the credit card transaction per? What's the percentage?
The cost is the total cost in the budget. We have $2,160,045.
And that's generated from assessment fees to the...
I think that's generated through the charges to customers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I meant. So it's $2.1 million?
In the budget, in the 0305 budget, we have $2.1 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's not a separate charge to customers. It just comes out of their total revenue stream, which are the liquor taxes and...
Part of the cost of...
By the cost of doing business.
Correct. And what... Do we know what percentage that is?
What percentage is that?
What bank collects it, and who do we pay that to, Satish, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's U.S. Bank.
It is U.S.
And the rate is?
And the rate is, I would have to ask the agency that. We may have to get back to you.
Mr. Chair, Karen Gregory, for the record. The rate is about 1.6%. It has fluctuated in the last few years, but that's what I knew of most recently.
Okay. Who negotiates the rate? Is that still with the Treasury?
The Treasury Department.
All right. Chairman. I beg your pardon. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That does seem actually like quite a good rate, but do you know, does the Treasury Department, do they go through some type of competitive process and establish, because there is quite a, there has been established quite a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a brokerage profession in the sense of people shopping for businesses to get the best rates from providers for credit cards. So there are people actually now employed as intermediaries to get the best rate. Do we know what process the Treasury Department uses in terms of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I do not. I do believe they use a competitive rate, and I think it goes out every couple of years. But as far as giving you the details of it, I really can't tell you that. And just as a clarification, 1.8 is the current rate.
1.8?
1.8.
Transactions.
That's a very good rate.
Mr. Chairman, I believe... The Treasury Department comes before this committee also, so we can ask that question when they...
I just need to ask a question there. Is there any preclusion for the liquor stores themselves to have ATMs in the stores?
Mr. Chairman, a number of the liquor stores do have ATMs, And as far as the credit cards, liquor agents do not have to carry the credit card system. It is really up to them as to whether they have credit cards.
Okay. But there's no cost to them to take credit cards as an agent?
Mr. Chairman, not for the sale of distilled spirits. There is a cost to them for the sale of related items. So if they have a large related items business, they do have to pay a certain dollar amount each month to pay for the charges for those related items. But for the sale of distilled spirits, the state picks up those costs.
How is that segregated, Karen?
Alex would actually be the better person to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Alex Lennox again. We basically survey agents periodically. Our auditors, when they go out and audit liquor stores, look at sales for a three-day period. Pick three random days and look at total sales that go over the counter and then total related item sales. And then we make assumptions that X percentage on average of their sales are for related items, and as a result, X percentage of the credit card sales are related item sales, and we base the fee on that. There are some stores that have extremely high related item sales, and we're basing their charges on their actual related item sales and not system-wide averages. It I think works out to approximately 10 or 12% of our total credit card fees are end up being reimbursed by agents. It's associated with related item sales.
So they actually have to basically pay back because all the credit cards are processed through the card system.
Essentially, we deduct it out of their compensation check, but yes, they.
I see. Okay. So it's an actual adjustment then.
Right.
And then, Alex, while you're making that calculation, when I look at the total of the pie, 97.4 other funds and a 2.6 other funds non-limited at 2.6%, I need to know, and I don't need to know this very instant, I need to know how the 1.8% becomes 2.6% of this total pie. So if you could help me with that, that's an algebraic computation. I just need to know how it relates, how 1.8% becomes 2.6% of the other funds.
I will try, Representative Butler.
Thank you
for Satish's material.
Yeah.
Sure, I will try to provide you an explanation. Otherwise, I think the agents will help. So while the 2.6% is of the total budget, if you look at the agency's total budget, if you look at the table, if you look on page 2, you'll see that the agency's total budget is $83.47 million. So out of that, $81.3 million is other funds limited. This is the agency's operating budget as well as agent comp. The 2.2 is the portion that translates to the 2.6%, which is non-limited, and the agency has done an estimate that this is what would be needed to cover the cost of processing credit card transactions.
So even though it's 1.8%, it's 2.6% of the other funds, of the total funds expenditure.
And this is a slight increase from 2001-03. If you look at the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget, it was $2,087,000. So there has been an increase of $73,045 for 2003-05.
Any modification of the total percentage of sales going out in credit at that time? Or is that just applied at the standard percentage?
I think that was done by the agency based on their forecast of sales, right, Alex?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have seen astronomical growth in the use of credit cards and bank cards in general in the liquor stores. When the system originally started in 1996, we were using an estimate of 12% of our over-the-counter sales would use credit cards or debit cards. As of the end of December of 2002, for calendar year 2002, we were at 41%. Of our counter sales, and that percentage increase has slowed, but it's continuing to grow. We're probably in the low to mid 40s right now. And I would expect by the end of the year we'll be looking at somewhere around 45%.
Is there a charge for the debit cards?
Mr. Chair, there is. The 1.8% that Karen Gregory mentioned is a composite
a
average. A blended rate.
Okay.
There actually is a different rate for each kind of credit card. So Discover has a different rate. MasterCard or Visa check card has a different rate. And there's also different rates depending on how it's used. And it's a very complicated calculation.
And American Express has another different rate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's true, but we don't accept American
don't
Express.
Don't accept American Express.
Well, business community doesn't like that.
Senator Winters?
Following along on that, when you, based on these calculations, do you also, in looking at compensation, since you're picking up the cost of the credit cards, do you add that to the compensation column to determine your rates to the agents?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no, we do not.
We do not. So that's not figured in.
But that would be under the, on the graph on page 4, that would be under just the other expenses, less freight and liquor costs and so forth. It'd be, that cost would then be in that box before the commissions are calculated.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And so we are anticipating the growth, and that's the reason why the 3.5% of the other funds not limited, 3.5% increase in other funds not limited is an increase in the number of credit card transactions. So with that,
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. It's just a forecasted increase in usage.
Okay. Satish?
So we are in page 4. Mr. Chair, and
it takes you a long time to get page 4, doesn't it?
The major changes approved during the various special sessions we've had. During the second special session, there was a reduction of $603,449 other funds of unspecified operating costs. This resulted in an additional distribution to the general fund of $337,931. And this is because for every dollar that the commission does not spend, and there is an additional distribution of 56 cents to the general fund. During the third special session, there was an addition of about $1.2 million other funds for employee compensation adjustments, but this item you see in every agency's budget. And during the 2002 fifth special session, there was a reduction of about $1.2 million other funds of unspecified operating costs, and this generated an additional $671,010 distribution to the general fund. And now the major items in the governor's budget. The governor's budget eliminates 15.5 full-time equivalent positions in the regulatory and in the administrative and support services program areas. There are also additional operating costs to create more distribution to the general fund, and it allows the agency to assist the University of Oregon and Oregon State University in enforcing liquor laws, especially during their home games. Now if you go to look at page 5, the chart there shows the various program units within the department, and you'll see that around 58% of the budget is for agents' compensation, 16% is for support services, 16% for regulatory, and about 10% for merchandising. There's a very small percentage, 0.2% for capital improvements.
So, Keith, let me just go back to the final comment on our major programs and services included in the governor's budget. The 15.5 full-time positions from regulatory, administrative, and support services reduces the operating costs and allows the agency to assist University of Oregon, Oregon State University, in enforcing liquor laws. How does a reduction in the full-time equivalency allow an agency to assist with other enforcement?
Mr. Chair, those are three different items. What we have is
I see.
The elimination of the 15.5 positions are from the agency's current budget.
I beg your pardon. So those are three different plans,
three different programs. Programs, and I will be talking more about it because we have policy packages that...
And the capital improvements at 0.2%, that's capital improvements that are projected this biennium.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the percentage of the budget for capital improvements.
Okay.
Which is
2003-2005.
Okay. If we go to page 6, this shows the various budget categories. Around 68% of the agency's budget is services and supplies, and this also includes agent compensation. 31% is personal services, and 0.4% is capital outlay. Now, how was the governor's budget developed? It may be helpful if you turn to page 21 of the governor's balanced budget binder. The starting point was the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget, and this consisted of $29.2 million total funds. Again, this is page 21. It's under the agency summary.
Page 21?
Page 21 under the agency summary. So I'll just walk you through this. The starting point was the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget consisting of $79.2 million total funds. Then there was a decrease of $603,449 other funds as a result of the actions taken by the legislature during the second special session. Next, we have base budget adjustments. There is the adjustment for the cost of living adjustments approved during the 2001-2003, the cost of living increases for the 2001-2003 biennium. Then there's the anticipated increase in cost of retirement and health benefits, and the cost to fund the 2003-2005 merit increases. This leads to an increase of $3,451,915 total funds. You will see that this number will decrease as a result of the decision not to provide the 3% cost of living adjustments, and this may further decrease based on what happens to PERS. And next, we have a base non-limited adjustment of $73,046. And this is non-limited other funds. This is for the credit card charges that we talked about earlier. Now, under essential packages, under package 010, there's an increase of $684,548 other funds. These are adjustments for mass transit taxes, overtime, temporary appointments, differential costs, and vacancy savings. And under package 020, there are program adjustments. This package restores $380,000 other funds of one-time reductions taken during the second special session. This is out of the $603,000 that was reduced earlier. It also adds $2,023,211 other funds to maintain the agent's compensation at 8.54% of sales. Lastly, it phases out $1,532,304 other funds of one-time expenditures. These are related to information technology projects. Under package 030, we have adjustments for inflation as well as for state government service charges. And this is an increase of $2.3 million. Next, we have the policy packages. Package 081, it provides a reduction of $14,550 other funds for elimination of the 3% cost of living adjustment for employees at salary range 38 or higher. And package 091, it is a program reduction package. This was also the result of the actions taken during the fifth special session. There's a reduction of $2,213,371 other funds and 15.5 full-time equivalent positions in the regulatory and administration and support services programs. Out of this, 11 positions are in the regulatory program area, and this includes four liquor regulatory specialists, one regional manager, two compliance specialists, three positions, as well as four support positions. The remaining 4.5 full-time equivalent positions come out of administration and support services, and this includes 1.25 full-time equivalent program tech 2 position, and the remaining are support services positions. And besides the positions, there is a reduction in regulatory program of $147,000 in services and supplies. And in administration and support, there's a reduction of $672,430 other funds in services and supplies and capital outlay. Next, we have package 206. Package 206, it increases other funds expenditure limitation by $15,352 other funds to enable the agency to assist the two universities, Oregon State and University of Oregon, during their football games.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
There's been no problems at Portland State or the other university systems, just those two?
I believe, Mr. Chair, the two universities approached OLCC for their services, and the Commission has been providing services to these universities, but this does provide an avenue for them to receive revenues and spend these on overtime costs.
Mr. Chair.
Please follow.
Does those two universities have security on staff during their events?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think they do, but the Liquor Commission staff help the security people in enforcing liquor laws. For example, I think last fall when they had the riots at the University of Oregon, the OLCC people were there to help them. And this increase will not cause any reduction to the distribution to the general fund, because this is something that will be coming out of the agency's budget and will be going out to pay overtime costs.
We'll get a little deeper into that as we go along.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it is more than likely that will come out of the athletic funds from the universities to pay OLCC for the...
And Senator Winters, with regards to your question about Portland State, maybe the Commission has a better idea if they've been having any problems.
So there's going to be a revenue item somewhere in the amount of
$15,352.
And that way we use OLCC support staff to assist on overtime and those kinds of things at those games.
Mr. Chairman, I think they were going to respond about Portland State, but I think I know what the response probably... Portland State plays its games at PGE Park, so they come under that the agreement with PGE Park, which sure has pretty extensive alcohol control requirements. Being
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, that's absolutely right. And the reason that this opportunity came up is because the University of Oregon and Oregon State actually have state budgets, and they're able... They have wanted to devote a portion of their budget to allow our liquor inspectors to work their games, to supplement their security people. We have done that slightly in the past, but as our staff members begin diminishing and we're cutting our overtime hours, it really became more important that we get the funding from them to help us do that work.
Senator Devlin, is that responsive to your...
Yes, it is, actually. And just a comment is that I've been to games at PG Park, and I've been to games at Autzen Stadium, and I don't go to games at that other place.
Thank you.
But I think the behavior is more rational at PG Park than it is sometimes at Autzen Stadium. There might be more need for... control of liquor.
My question was getting at the behavior, because when you look at the university system, the question becomes, you have two universities out of the seven, and you've got these that are problematic, particularly down there where you go. I prefer the other one myself. that was the reason for my question.
Thank you very much. I guess
loftier than
tantamount to when they break out a package of Coca-Cola at a BYU game, huh?
Yeah. Or okay. now that Western Oregon now is no longer dry.
Oh, yeah, no longer dry. Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Satish. I appreciate that explanation. Further comments or questions on behalf of budget and management? Okay, I think we're down to you, Steve. Let's proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. If you would please turn to the merchandising tab. For the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of Purchasing and Distribution. I'm going to report on the merchandising program. As mentioned before, the merchandising program operates the state's distilled liquor business and is committed to making distilled spirits reasonably available while not promoting them. The program generates significant revenues. In the 2002 fiscal year, there were $258 million that were generated, with over $104 million coming back to the general fund and local communities. After Prohibition in 1933, the states were given the rights to regulate alcohol. There's essentially two systems that they can use. They can use the license or open system, in which they license someone else to sell the alcohol, or they can do the control system, which essentially the state takes control of the liquor somewhere in the distribution process. There are three major aims of the merchandising program put forth in the OLCC business plan. One, we want to run the merchandising program with good, sound business principles. Two, we want to meet stakeholder needs. And three, we want to make improvements through modernization and the use of technology. It's very important that we continue to modernize in order to stay up in the retail market. This then supports our retailing goals. First and foremost of our retailing goals is to have clean, attractive stores out there with good customer service, all the while maintaining high profitability for the state and for local communities, while providing adequate compensation for our agents based upon their performance. We support our retailing goals by handling all facets of the wholesale and retail operations. As part of that operation, we operate a distribution center which supplies the liquor to these stores. We have within the distribution center the liquor supplies, which are owned by the companies that send those liquor supplies in. We do not take possession of that or own that until we ship that to the stores. At that time, we take possession up to the point where it sells to the customers. In 1996, we had a conversion from what we would have as the state-owned liquor to supplier-owned. That's called bailment, and that resulted in a one-time saving of $8 million for the state. Once the liquor is sold, the state then compensates the liquor store agent, who pays all their operating costs for their store. The agent's compensation program is the basis of which we pay our agents. For the 2003-2005 governor's balanced budget, based on anticipated sales of $561 million, the budget for agents' comp is almost $48 million. All of the liquor stores in the state are contracted agents. The agents are very committed to the communities and the state as a whole. They do an excellent job for us. Sell the liquor products, then handle and deposit the proceeds into state accounts, and manage the $11 million inventory in their stores. As said before, the agents are paid once the sales take place. They are paid on a monthly basis. From that monthly compensation, they have to go ahead and cover all costs associated with their stores. That's the rent, lighting, heat, staffing, taxes, etc. Also from that compensation, they must also pay themselves their salaries, insurance, Social Security, taxes, and retirement plan. Now I want to cover the background, performance, and accomplishments of the OLCC business plan. There have been a few changes to the system since the early 1980s until 2000. In the early 1980s, the last of the state-owned liquor stores was converted to the semi-private system of agent-owned stores. The number of stores from 1985 to 2000 had not changed. There have also been minimal infrastructure improvements. The business plan developed in 1999 helped lead us to modernize and grow to meet expanded retail needs. Due to the population and tourism increase, there have been a much demand increase in terms of liquor products. But to handle that, we actually had less OLCC employees to meet that case demand and to oversee the support of the stores. Customer expectations had also changed as well. Certainly, all customers expect clean, attractive, convenience stores, and they certainly, in this day and age, want more product variety. That's one thing we're certainly seeing. The plan goals are consistent with what Oregon residents had to say in a year 2000 study conducted by Capital Long Resources for the OLCC. Surveys showed that Oregon residents were generally satisfied with the system and did not want any radical changes. It also showed that most Oregonians did not buy alcohol, or if they did, they did so infrequently. The survey identified that the majority of customers shop locally, that they favor their liquor stores, and would like them to stay open a little later, especially on weekends. We also found in some cases they thought that some of the stores were hard to find. Important to note, like all customers everywhere, they value cleanliness, good selection, and a helpful, knowledgeable staff. major business plan goals had to deal with the issues that pulled the system in two different directions. The system, which had pretty much stayed the status quo for a number of years, while population, tourism, and customer demand had increased, while we experienced diminishing resources and staff due to Measure 5 and had an expanded need for technology and modernization, as well as Agents Comp, pulled us in another direction. The merchandising program operates with a very lean staff. Even as sales demand greatly increased, the merchandising program actually lost 7-time full-time equivalent employees. The remaining staff had to absorb that additional workload. There are only 5 store staff to oversee the day-to-day operations of all liquor agents within the state. Increased sales demand have placed a greater need on added stores and greater expectations on the distribution center staff, store staff, and liquor agents as a whole. It was clear that additional stores were needed. In 1985, there were 234 stores. In 1999, 14 years later, there were still only 234 stores.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Do you have a comparison as to what the profit margins were in 1995 and versus when you started adding new stores?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, are you talking about for the profit margin for each individual store?
When you add other stores, does the profit margin shrink or reduce?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we do a cost survey on an annual basis, and while we can't give you the information store by store, we do have information for the class of stores, so we can bring that back to you tomorrow.
It was also apparent that many of the stores needed to relocate to new population centers for shopping convenience. Liquor agents also needed to realize that further investments in moving to better locations would be rewarded with increased sales. It is very important to note, at this time, existing long-term leases and high rent for premium retail space continue to be a major obstacle in placement of or relocation of the liquor stores. The rents keep on climbing very quickly. In an effort to upgrade the general appearance of the liquor stores, the OLCC revised its agent evaluation policy to place added emphasis on these goals. There is a 3-tier rating system that rewards agents for meeting OLCC goals. First one, an outstanding. If you get an outstanding rating, you can get a contract of 10 years. If you get a satisfactory rating, you can get a contract for 5 years. And an unsatisfactory rating will yield you a contract of no more than 1 year while you have time to make improvements.
Are those rating scores super objective, Mr. Farrell?
Mr. Chair, we have gone to great lengths to make those as objective as possible.
Okay. And do we have that criteria within the binders that we've been provided?
Mr. Chairman, the criteria is not there, but we'll certainly provide it for you.
Provide that so that each member of the committee would have those objective criteria of which you're using for those 10, 5, and 1-year extensions, please?
We'd be happy to.
Are there folks that are moving up on the scale from 1 year to 5 year and 5 year to 10 year? Agents that are moving up each year in that, as well as agents that maybe move down?
Mr. Chairman, it actually is a bit fluid. But part of that is because we've been tweaking the evaluation as well. We totally rewrote the evaluation a few years ago. We discovered that there were some problems with it, so we've been working with agents and making it better.
Karen, for the biennium, and I don't know, during a biennium of the 234 agents, it's assumed that maybe 50 of those would be up for reevaluation. I don't know, but maybe more. But could we have, for the past YNM, those that moved, those that were static, 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, those that moved up, and those that moved down? I'd like to have some numbers.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we evaluate all agents every year, so we'll bring you the
Wonderful.
Last couple of years.
I would appreciate knowing how many are getting better, how many are staying the same status quo, and if we do have some that are being downgraded, then what appears to be the consistent reason if we are having some downgrades, what areas we're falling short in.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back just a little bit on the time of day, and the question is, evening is the most common time of day to shop, and most favorite stores staying open later, especially on weekends. Since the Sunday legislation, what has been the experience? How many of them stay open now on Sundays, and whether or not they actually have received an increase in revenue? Could you give us some insight into that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, at this time we see about 25% that have taken advantage of the opportunity to stay open on Sundays and or the legal holidays. And if you talk with many of the agents that stay open on Sundays, you'll get from one end of the spectrum to the other. Some have seen regularly increasing sales. In fact, we're very surprised to see how quickly they increased. Others have been much more static in terms of their sales.
So a mixed bag.
Yes, Senator Winters. One of the things, while meeting customer improvements, it is also critical that we maintain high profitability. We do that by controlling costs through improved technology, which yields greater efficiencies and avoids additional staffing requirements. We also work hard to have the products that customers want, while still minimizing the inventories. A keystone to making the program work is maintaining an equitable agents' compensation system. It's very important that we reward the agents who meet the established goals and invest in their stores. It is also important to note that they work very hard to meet the high level of liquor law compliance that we have in terms of expectation for them.
Can I just ask a question in that regard relative to the inventory investments? You said there's about $11 million out in the stores that actually belongs to OLCC.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And is virtually everything in the warehouse all on consignment bailment? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it was all on bailment except for a few minor shippers or suppliers. We have since the 1st of January converted everything over.
Okay.
So what you would have in the distribution center, you do have a relatively small inventory for our split case division in there.
Right,
we
that
have to
front line, that very front line is owned by the, and that's included, that front line is included in the $11 million.
The $11 million that I was referring to was just the stores. We run anywhere from 400 to maybe 900,000 in terms of warehouse inventory.
Okay, so that's a 500,000 jump from 4 to 9, but it's something less than a million on that front line all the time.
Mr. Chair, that jump can take place for any number of different reasons. Sometimes prices become very good on some products. We will do a major buy on that to go ahead and have advantage in the marketplace. If we get shipments back in, we will go ahead and pick up some additional inventory dollars there, but it does sort of move back and forth.
That's interesting. You mentioned if you can get a good buy on something, that means that you'll pass that straight through to the customer under your pricing program.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. And finally, with regard to the inventories that's in the store, have there been any discussions about allowing the agents to own their own inventory and be able to order what they believe they would need, as opposed to having the state work that out on a matrix as to what they sold and what they think they need?
Mr. Chair, there has certainly been some discussion. I don't know how far that discussion has gone.
Mr. Chairman, there has been informal discussion within the commission regarding that issue. It has never gone as far as a policy decision to the commissioners, but it's certainly something that, you know, has been discussed, the pros and the cons, at least at a staff level.
Karen, have the agents ever asked you if has that been an issue, that they could buy their own inventory?
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of agents who have made that request, but quite frankly, most agents, that's quite an investment for them, and most agents wouldn't be terribly interested in that, simply because the investment is so large. But there have been a few that would be very interested in that concept.
It would be about $47,000 per agent on $11 million divided by 234 stores, something under $50,000 average. It's an item that was just brought up in a discussion.
Mr. Chairman,
that isn't right. $470,000. I'm off of decimal error.
Certainly one fourth.
And, Mr. Chairman, for your larger stores, the inventory investment, of course, would be substantially larger. And for your smaller stores, it would be less. So there is a spectrum of the investment needed.
Wouldn't be $470,000.
No, it wouldn't. A medium-sized store is about $150,000 in retail, which is about $75,000 at cost. Your larger stores are going to be about double that, and your smaller stores, of course, you know, will be about half of that.
Okay. It was an item that someone had asked me why the liquor stores didn't or couldn't own their own inventory, and if that would be of assistance to us in the ordering process, if stores could order. Excuse me, I understand that there's a concern that the commission tells the stores what they think they'll sell, and they can't order exactly what it is that they feel like that they will be selling, and I don't know whether that's a valid
concern. Mr. Chairman, at this point, whatever a liquor agent orders is typically what they get. The only time that they will get something different is if they special order something. They fill in what we call a customer request order, and if they're filling in a customer request order for an item that doesn't have an actual customer's name on it, then the stores division may decide after talking to that agent that we're not going to fill that order. But if it's one of the 1,200 items we have in stock in our warehouse, if they fill their order in, be it electronic or Scantron or whatever, they get the product, unless we're out of stock.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I might also point out that certainly several years ago while we were trying to get the inventories under control, there was a certainly a much greater restriction in some of that. Recently, we have continued to loosen that up as stores have shown that they have control over their inventory. So we have been much more flexible in terms of, you know, sending the special orders out to the agents, even though they perhaps didn't have some sales.
Good.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to go over some program highlights. The merchandising program continues to be very efficient. The return on investments, which is certainly a good measure for us, is a net annual profit of between 39 and 40%. To improve the shopping experience, we've added 6 new stores since the business plan was adopted, and we've got another one approved. Agents continue to upgrade to better store locations. In fact, in the last 2 years, 9 agencies have relocated, and virtually all of them have seen increase in sales. We are very appreciative of agents who have been proactive in improving their store appearance. I might point out that we try and work as closely as we can with agents, and many of them have seen that the changes that needed to be made, they have been proactive and made those changes on their own. Since 1997, 20 agencies have noted major improvements, with another 17 making somewhat smaller changes. We expect those trends to continue.
Do any of the stores, are any of the stores physically owned by the state, the actual facilities themselves?
Mr. Chair, no.
Any capital improvements outside of the Milwaukee facility owned by the Liquor Control Commission?
Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you.
As I pointed out before, we have improved customer service to the fact that we have seen improvement in hours, and also the 25% or so of the agents that stay open on the Sundays or holidays. We have increased the number of regularly available liquor items and carry about 1,200 to 1,300 different products at any given time within the distribution center. We continually review that mix of product to go ahead and try and make sure that it's meaningful for the marketplace.
Representative Johnson. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many agents have taken advantage of staying open on Sunday?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, about 25% at this point stay open either on Sundays or legal holidays.
And that's purely voluntary and a choice of the agent, is it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Please continue.
As I mentioned before, we continually review our product mix. We work very closely with both the agents and the industry to go ahead and make sure there are meaningful products out there. Our product in-stock rate for the year 2001-2002 exceeded 99.3%. There is certainly a regular need to have reinvestments back into the business as a way to stay up with growth. We have invested in new technology and equipment to maintain productivity. Reinvestment is very critical. Since 1992, the distribution staff has decreased from 41 to 36 full-time equivalent employees, while seeing an almost 20% rise in cases shipped. This was accomplished through higher individual productivity. In 1996, we shipped slightly over 1.5 million cases. By 2002, that had risen to slightly over 1.8 million cases, a little less than 20%. The liquor industry certainly is helping drive some of the increases out there. They've expanded their advertising, their specialty brands, and they are targeting specific markets with new products. I always have a saying, if you can dream it, they can make it.
Is there, how much opportunity is there for interaction between the liquor distributors and suppliers and the agents themselves, recognizing that those liquor distributors or liquor companies themselves might have a pretty good sales program to convince those folks, but unless they can convince everybody, including you folks in Milwaukee, and then continue that momentum to the 234 agents, that's the best way for them to get the message out of those new products. Is there a pretty good opportunity? We've seen the trade magazines from yesterday. Is there a pretty good opportunity for those folks to get their story out to everyone?
Mr. Chair, there is a very regular opportunity for them. In fact, that's what they do. That's how they create often the pool for some of their new products. They go out and talk to licensees, which are the bars, taverns, restaurants. They also go in and talk to the agents themselves about the products, how much sales is going to be behind them, how much advertising. Many of the companies do very good in-depth studies before they bring the products to market. So between the day-to-day activities where they're meeting with the licensees that then create demand, that the licensees, once they are convinced by the liquor broker or liquor representative that it's a good product and they want to carry it, will then go ahead and task their local store to go ahead and carry that item for them. So there's a pull-through mechanism. But it's also an opportunity that can take place through special orders. The industry representative can go in and see a particular agent, make his sales pitch, and if the marketplace that that particular agent handles, if he believes that it would do good in his marketplace, oftentimes he can put in a special order and get that product in even before it's regularly listed with us.
Does the OLCC act as a conduit for that information or as a common meeting area to distribute industry information? How is that driven, from the top down or from the bottom up? Where do those two meet?
Mr. Chair, it is the primary objective of the industry to create that specific customer demand and information flow. We do have...
So that would be with the agents?
That's correct. Okay. Or with the bar, tavern, restaurant owners,
okay,
which help pull that. So that's the primary way that they go ahead and do that. We also, six times a year, meet to discuss with and review proposed increasing product lines by the industry. There are agents that sit on those committees that review those products.
So that there's a dissemination of information back and forth, free flow of information, top to bottom.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, we hear from agents when a particular product is brought into the marketplace. We have recently had where, in fact, it also works from the public themselves. We had a great deal of demand with a particular product that was Big Back East. The industry had not promoted it out here. In fact, they had not really brought it forward. We started getting most of our pull through the agents themselves from the you know, person that walks in off the street and said, I would like to get this product. So the pull of products into the system and the information flow can come from an individual. It can come from a representative of a liquor industry. It can come from the agent. They attend trade shows. So the free flow of information back and forth about the products is certainly quite prevalent out there.
And you feel like that there's a good forum for that, and it's fostered by the Liquor Control Commission and encouraged that.
Mr. Chair, we work very hard to work with the industry and the agents. That's why the committee that reviews the proposed products to come in does have a three-member agent group that sits on that committee. And one of the other things that we have done certainly in recent years is we have an open-door policy with the industry. Oftentimes, the industry will find products that all of a sudden pop in the marketplace. They will come in, and even though we don't have a standard meeting set up for that, they will come in and make their pitch, and if it seems like the market really needs to have that product out there right away, we will move very quickly to do that without waiting for the formal process.
And so you feel like you're being responsive to the free flow of information
responsive to the needs in the marketplace.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We consider ourselves very flexible, and you can certainly feel free to speak to the industry. I think they have a very very easy access to us, and we work very closely with them. And the agents can meet customer demand. That's our job.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the chairman's indulgence, I want to shift about 180 degrees.
Okay.
Has there been in recent years any indication that more sales are going to alternative, basically, types of transactions than through the liquor stores? Are we seeing anything? I mean, I obviously don't know. I mean, you've obviously got internet sales, I believe, in wine, but I don't think you can have them for distilled spirits. I'm not sure about that. But you've also got, of course, with more travel with people with the name Georgia adjacent states that might have lesser markups. Are we seeing any loss that is actually due to people utilizing alternatives for purchasing products?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, first of all, it is illegal to have any internet sales on either beer or distilled spirit.
Yeah.
Does it happen? Yes, it happens. And when we find out whether it happens, when it happens, we do get in touch with either the retailer or the wholesaler who is providing that product into the state. We write them a letter and ask for them, you know, not to do that. And actually, we've been pretty successful in that regard. When people go to other states, you can actually bring any of the products back in a certain limit. And certainly wine, if it's a reciprocal state, you can have two cases of wine shipped to your home every month. On distilled spirits, I don't remember the limits, but you can bring some of that back for personal use as well. A number of years ago, we actually did a study with a survey company who called a number of Oregon residents and talked to them about their consumption rates and so on of the various products, and when they went to other states, whether they brought things back and so on. And it was a survey so that, you know, their name wasn't attached to it, so they knew that we weren't going to go and do bad things to them if they did bring in over the case limits and so on. And really what we discovered is that, yes, there is some of that bleeding across state lines, but it's not as much as one might believe. And actually, the state of Washington's prices, particularly on distilled spirits, at least on the low and moderate ends, are substantially higher than ours. So we have that group of people coming across our borders and purchasing from Oregon. But certainly, there is a bit of bleeding on the south end going into California and going into Nevada. But we lose some, certainly, but we don't lose a tremendous amount.
We haven't seen, though, any real expanded loss of sales due to the alternative, beyond what we would normally have experienced in recent prior years.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it's certainly not more prevalent. And if we do have the bleeding on the southern end, so to speak, we're more than likely making up a lot of that at our northern end with Washington.
What of Idaho and Nevada?
Mr. Chair, Nevada would be the same sense as California. There's certainly a little bit of bleeding there. But again, people can bring product in on a legal basis to a certain extent.
Certainly.
And Idaho, I'm not real familiar with their prices, are you?
Yeah, I don't think there would be much coming from Idaho.
So it's 55-gallon drums coming across in Ontario that you got to watch
right.
out for.
Right, yeah. And my wife's station wagon. Right?
That's, I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be that specific, Mr. Chair.
Root beer.
Is there a limit on root beer across state lines?
Mr. Chair, there was. You know, and maybe the practice was discontinued, but there was a situation where someone went to Nevada and was on their way, I believe it was to Alaska, and was carrying distilled spirits to their business establishment, which was a club up there. So one of our local state troopers caught him, and they paid the working penalty. So, yeah, I recall that because the call came into the ombudsman's office wanting to help.
And liquor stores, well, that's something that's yet to be discussed. Liquor stores buy from, or the retail distributors or liquor by the drink distributors, bars and restaurants, buy from the liquor stores in Oregon. Can they buy from any third state?
They have to buy, Mr. Chair, they have to buy from the liquor stores in Oregon.
So a way to cheapen up the product to cross the state line would not be legal. Is that something that's checked in the regulatory process?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, our licensees get a 5% discount. And we don't have the staff to go out and check all of our licensees. However, our liquor agents are pretty good at letting us know if there's a licensee who used to purchase large quantities and then all of a sudden they stop. We have done some investigations on some licensees who actually have gone across the border, and they have gotten some notices of violation and so on.
Okay. Representative Patrick?
Oh, I was just going to say we've had, even when I was in the district attorney's office, we had investigations in regard to people doing the evasion piece, buying out of Nevada specifically, as Representative, or as Senator Winters has said, and bring it into the state. And that was for a nonprofit, so... Always interesting.
A nonprofit.
And we're keeping administrative costs.
For some fundraising events that they were bringing it across the board.
Well, they won't raise as much fund after they pay the Oregon tax, no, will they? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I also want to point out that we work very closely with Oregon companies, companies like Hood River Distillery or Brandy Peak or Clear Creek. We work closely with them to make sure that their products are as available as possible to all the agents, and we certainly encourage that. To further meet growth, we have implemented a new modern warehouse management system software within our distribution center in order to help improve productivity and accuracy. That system also uses radio frequency scanning devices. The system uses scanners to read the industry barcodes on the bottles and cases. And this, as I mentioned, has improved both productivity and accuracy. Additional infrastructure improvements such as conveyors, dock truck locks in the distribution center have provided greater efficiency and safety.
Are those conveyors working well for us? I've been told that they may be a little light for the product.
Mr. Chair, they seem to be working fine. Sometimes we do have the companies, especially around the holidays, come in with very big cases, very heavy cases, 60, 70 pounds, and what we've had to do recently is usually have those close to the shipping dock and actually put those straight onto the trucks, primarily not so much because of the weight, but because of the size.
Okay.
The OLCC Distribution Center has also been a leader in the recycling effort. In fact, as mentioned before, in 2001, we received the Governor's Resource Steward Award for our recycling efforts, and that also gave us an opportunity to control our disposal costs. Another important way the merchandising program controlled costs was an inventory reduction of state liquor assets. In an agreement with the 1999 Ways and Means Subcommittee, the OLCC and its agents targeted a $2.9 million reduction in inventory investments so that the agents' compensation would not have to be reduced. This was all achieved by working with liquor agents and setting annual inventory goals. The established goals take into account such factors as changes in location, store improvements, sales growth patterns, and other related retail issues. The OLCC works very closely with agents to see if they can meet those goals, although I might want to point out again that we only have 5 store staff that actually can get around the state to work with them on a regular basis. Sell-through of liquor products, that's a bottle goes on the shelf, sells, and then is replaced, or turnover of stores' inventory showed just how significant and successful our efforts have been. In 1997, we did 9.6 turns per year. By 2000, that had moved up to 10.4, 2001, 11.5, and in 2002, 12.1. The upcoming biennium, we certainly have several priorities that we want to work toward. Number one is certainly to modernize the stores, to improve customer service, and also increase the convenience in which the public can go ahead and purchase from us. Improved technology will be a key to further improvements. Without the investment in technology to modernize, we will be hard-pressed to continue our efficiency and productivity gains. We take great pride in the improvements that we have made in the merchandising program, and we want to continue our efforts to run it in a more business-like manner. A major point will be our new performance-based agents reappointment philosophy, with added emphasis on rewarding agents for meeting our goals. Agents' compensation continues to be a long-term critical issue. Without adequate compensation, agents cannot afford to provide the retail environment consumers desire and our business plan encourages. We look forward to and will continue to work with all stakeholders to review agents' compensation so that it reinforces our long-term goals while providing the liquor agents with a means to see that they can accomplish them. I want to thank you for listening to my report about the retail business plan, our accomplishments, and our hopes for the next biennium, and I look forward to answering any questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you. Are there questions, Mr. Farrell? I just noticed that in moving from 97 at less than 10 times turnover to 2002, to over 12 times turnover, that's got to be a tremendous utilization of our assets. There are some stores that do a better job than the 12 time turnover.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We have some stores that do significantly better, and we have some stores that are significantly lower.
Is there some business practice that you can ascribe to the high end and the low end? Some that are doing such a good job and know why they're doing it?
Mr. Chair, first of all, 12 turns a year is really, really good.
You bet. How does it compare industry-wide?
It's very high.
Okay.
If you're a store that's turning 15 or 16 times, my concern gets to be that those folks may be out of product. They may not have enough in their store to actually supply licensees who might need a quantity. So from our perspective, we really would like agents globally to be very close to the 12, and those who turn significantly higher, that's just as bad, really, as not turning high enough. You want to make sure that there is enough product in the stores so that all customers can be well served.
Yeah, they're just in time ordering, essentially. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something that you just said about in response to my question about Sunday sales, that 25% of the stores are doing Sunday sales. When Sunday sales were first approved by the legislature, how much additional revenue did you guys calculate, OLCC calculate, was going to come as a result of the Sunday sales?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I don't believe that we calculated additional sales due to Sunday sales. We were already running an increase at the time that became law, which I believe was in April of last year. And as Steve said, about 25% of the stores are open Sundays, but most of those stores are here on exclusive rural stores. The really large volume stores, there are a number of them who are open, and there are a number of them who opened during the holidays and then decided to close after that. So,
not so let me just make sure I understand this. As a result of that law passing, you all didn't adjust your overall revenue projections for the agency at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that is correct.
Representative Johnson, I think that came through. Maybe we could ask Legislative Fiscal how that happened. Susan Jordan could tell us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know where the $3 million if the additional revenue projection came from. The fiscal office pointed out in our fiscal impact statement that just because Sunday sales was going to occur did not mean that there would be an increase in revenue, but there was likely to be a shift of people buying on different days of the week. It did not come from our office.
Okay. Thank you.
Alex, were you going to kick in something there?
I was just willing to offering. Mr. Chair, I did the fiscal impact and our agency revenue impact and did a lot of research on the Sunday sales issue. And I think part of the initial revenue estimate was based on some experience in Ontario, Canada. They shifted to Sunday sales. And Ontario is a control system. They own all of their stores, so they force all of their own stores to open on Sundays. They claimed in their annual report in that year, 1997, that they had experienced an increase in sales. Well, I think the Legislative Revenue Office used that estimate, the numbers that came out of that, to come up with a number. I subsequently spoke with the folks in Ontario, and they said, well, we don't actually know if we had an increase in sales because of Sunday. Our sales in general just went up that year, but we can't ascribe that to Sunday sales. Our view for the agency was that we didn't expect many stores to open, and indeed not very many. I mean, a quarter of them did, but almost all of them are out in rural areas, and that we did not expect to see any significant change in sales. Essentially, it's a fairly standard marketing view of if customers want products, they buy it. And simply because the stores open an additional day doesn't mean there's going to be additional demand. If they can't get it on Sunday, they'll go Saturday. If they can't get it on Saturday, they'll go Friday or they'll go some other day. And I suspect that while some stores have experienced an increase in sales on Sundays, they tend to be in more heavily touristed areas. Sun River, for example, saw a fairly large increase in sales. Fairly small store. They're already open on Sundays, so fairly heavy tourist crowd. Most of the stores have not experienced a substantial change. The increase in sales that we've had is well within our margin of error for our forecast.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I believe that the other part of running that bill through session was to make it more equitable because grocery stores or package stores could sell beer and wine on Sundays, but liquor stores could not, and that was the other part of passing that bill out.
Thank you.
It's interesting, it's interesting to hear the agent side of it, too, that, you know, I mean, we've already got them at 40-plus hours a week, and so, you know, many of those agents have not been able to avail themselves of the additional time. I mean, they're already working trying to keep the books up on Sunday as it is, and the concern was that with the additional hired help, and virtually can't run one of these with fewer than a couple of people there all the time to protect yourselves, that in some cases you might have thousands and thousands of dollars worth of sale in a big store on Sunday, but by the time you subtract 50% for the state as your direct cost of goods, and then, you know, the other kinds of things where you come down to a 9% or 8.54% commission, subtract your lights and labor off of it, gets to be pretty skinny. I heard one figure of sale of over $2,000 in one day that generated about $7 loss. So it's, you know, I mean, once you get the labor in there, it's a hard deal. So I think we try and unfortunately that was probably one of those decisions that needed to be made relative to the equity in it, but we were projecting additional resource. I don't think the resource was really based upon anything other than increasing sales that we were already experiencing at that time. So but if it has created an equality for those people that want to stay open on Sundays, then fine, let's proceed with that. But I questioned at the time, and I actually discussed it with Director Erickson, and knew that that the commission hadn't been involved in the direct management of those numbers, and I questioned whether or not the agents actually were invited to participate at that point. We just made an executive decision amongst the legislature and moved forward with it. So. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question on this issue, and it may be in this document someplace, but could you point me to or share with me what the revenue is for just the licensing of restaurants and how much revenue that is? It may be in there somewhere, but if could you...
Yeah.
the license fees are about $6 million. They're on page...
On page 1 under Revenue 10, Senator.
And that's from all licensing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes. And actually, it's in the other book. It's in our book that we provided. And it's under the Revenue tab. It's still there.
Okay.
The first page on the Revenue tab.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Do we move on at this point after that regulatory? Is that what you get?
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Linda.
All my stuff here. Having experience at this committee, I'm putting my $5 in here because I cannot talk with that same acronym. So I'm going to try really hard, but it's not going to happen.
Thank you, Linda.
If I say an acronym that you don't know what it means, let me know.
We'll wave our hands wildly.
Anyway, for the record, I'm Linda Ignowski, Mr. Chairman, and committee members. I'm Linda Ignowski, the Regulatory Program Director for the Commission. On the regulatory tab, I have provided you a lot of information. I'm not going to go through all of it. I'll try to give you a brief summary of the major functions and activities of the program, and then if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those for you. So, the main responsibility of the regulatory program is to effectively regulate the sale and responsible use of the alcohol beverages to protect Oregon's public health and safety and community livability. So our goal in the regulatory program is to maintain statewide compliance with liquor laws by being by balancing being firm but fair and providing quality service through service and control. We believe that licensees and applicants expect a fair and responsive service from us. The public also expects to be able to purchase alcohol from a variety of outlets and locations. But we also expect licensees to comply with all liquor laws, especially when it deals with selling alcohol, preventing sales to minors and to intoxicated people. We also want licensees to be good neighbors and not have a negative impact on their neighborhood. So our staff works in balance, trying to balance all these concerns, working with a diverse group of people such as local law enforcement, local government, neighborhood associations to try to provide quality service but also promote responsible alcohol use. The regulatory program has three major functions. The first one is licensing, then service permits and enforcement, and I'll give you a brief overview of those three major functions. We're responsible for licensing only qualified applicants, our individuals, our businesses, to sell or manufacture or distribute alcohol in the state of Oregon. We have approximately 20 and a half full-time equivalent positions across the state who do the licensing work for the entire state. Last year alone, they processed over 5,100 licensing actions, and that's all the way from new outlets, change of ownerships, to licensing special events. Currently, we have over 10,000 licensees in the state of Oregon. The second function we have is issuing service permits and administering the server education program. Anyone who sells and serves alcohol by the drink must have a service permit. So they have to meet a qualifying criteria and also take the server education class and pass it. We currently have over 97,000 service permit holders in the state of Oregon. Our staff processes over 29,000 applications throughout the year in 1 year, and about 23,000 students take the server education class each year. Now, compliance and enforcement efforts, we focus on the compliance with liquor laws. We believe that licensees, if they know and understand the law, will stay in compliance, so we spend a great deal of our time in trying to provide education and training. Up front, before someone can receive a liquor license, they must take a law orientation class. We have recently changed this class because we know time is important to licensees. They used to have to come in and do a 2.5-hour class for us. We've changed it into a booklet with a test that goes with it that they can take with them and send back the test with. This has helped them. This is basically trying to give them an overview of all the laws that they need to be knowledgeable of and ask questions. So I can leave this here if you want to look at this.
Representative Johnson?
Does that apply to every waitress that would bring a glass of wine to a table in a restaurant? Is that any server that would take that test?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, this law orientation is only for licensees.
Okay.
Every server has to take server education, which is a different program. This is the law orientation is for just licensees. Any server who sells alcohol by the drink has to take server education and obtain a service permit.
And that's part of the regulatory process, and that comes through your department, Linda?
Yes. Yes, it is.
I think that's probably the single item, the single largest item that I've received information on relative to the OLCC's budget is probably the server education. And we need to have some information relative to the proposed changes there. Do you have some standalone information on the server education?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it in the packet, but I can sure provide you what you need for that.
Yeah, in as much as there's some reduction in positions there that has been funded with its own resources, I think we'd better have some information. Senator Winters?
Question. Most of the majority of the server education classes are done by other providers. Whether it's Chemeketa College, whether it's Oregon Restaurant Association, you have some other private entities that actually conduct the training in order to prepare the individual to take the test for the server's permit. Do you develop the curriculum for that? How? What's your relationship with those other providers?
Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we do provide the curriculum. In fact, I brought samples of our three curriculum. We have translated into Spanish and Chinese. So it's a model curriculum that is provided to all the providers. They are free to modify it to what they want to, but there's some standard curriculum that they need to follow. And so we provide them with the model curriculum, but they can modify it a little bit to their teaching style. We provide a lot of assistance to the providers. We're committed to evaluating every one of the teachers that are out there every year to make sure that we have quality education that's happening in these classes. There's some statutory requirements of these classes. One of them is that the class needs to be at least 4.5 hours of instruction. So we have to go out and make sure that requirement is being met. We provide a lot of teaching assistance for first-time providers. We've added a lot of interactive kind of mode. I don't know if you took this recently. You'd find that it's changed a great deal. It's not just teaching from a book and reading it. We have provided a lot of interactive activities to people really get and understand the curriculum. So there's a lot of activity that happens.
It's my understanding, one of the reasons that ORA began to get into the educational business, it was believed that, one, that they could do a more comprehensive instruction, and two, there had always been this issue of timing and availability. I know that when I had my restaurant, it was always a struggle to try to get my employees there because you may have one provider giving it on this day, somebody else wouldn't give it for 3 or 4 days later, and trying to get your staff scheduled in to make sure that they were licensed became a major issue. Is that still an issue out there in the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think our providers have really stepped up to the plate in trying to provide adequate schedules. Also, the Restaurant Association has developed a renewal class, which is on a CD-ROM, which is shorter class, which has really been helpful for the industry. And so that's been, they're also now presenting to us some other innovative ideas of trying to do this more through computerized technology. And so we're looking at that and see if that can happen. So we also put the schedule on our website, so you can go to our website and find out the schedules in your area.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Several follow-on questions that came as a result of the exchange that you just had with Senator Winters. I'm surprised that you said, and forgive me for not knowing this, that the statute mandates 4.5 hours of instruction versus a knowledge of a curriculum. I mean, it seems to me that some folks might get it in 2 hours and they sit there for the remaining 2.5. Some might not get it in 12 hours. Why it is that there is a statutory requirement for the time versus some kind of demonstration of the knowledge.
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, I don't know the history of why it was developed, but you're absolutely right.
Well, that's the next segue that I have. How often do you guys review your statutes with respect to your service to the industry and come to the conclusion that maybe a statute like this, I mean, you just admitted it, is kind of a dumb statute, and that maybe there's a smarter, better way to do it?
And Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, we have an advisory committee, and that also is developed by statute. That is geared towards advising the commission on policies and rulemaking, and they have been pretty active in the last few years. We have, this has been an issue. We haven't brought forward to a statute change, but it's something maybe that we should be looking at.
Two last questions. Did we develop that curriculum so that is a unique to Oregon curriculum, or did we go buy it off the shelf someplace?
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, this is our unique curriculum. We have shared it with a lot of different states because we were the first state to make a mandatory survey education program, and so a lot of states have followed us, and so we have provided our curriculum as a model for them.
And last question, Mr. Chair, have you guys done any analysis at all about the cost of getting you out of the training business entirely and having the restaurant industry do the training? And I just picked the restaurant industry as an example. It could be subbed out to the community college system in its entirety.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't believe we've done an analysis of moving out of it because it's in statute that we're required to do this. I don't think we've had to.
Which takes me circularly back how often you review your statutes to see if they still make sense.
You do it?
Mr. Please. Chair, Representative Johnson, if I could just interject here. Actually, we do not do any of the training ourselves. What we do is we provide the curriculum to the providers and to the instructors, and we make sure that their training is appropriate, that they are training 4.5 hours and so on, but the commission actually provides no training in this area.
Well, Mr. Chair, the point that I'm making is to take you folks out of the training entirely. I mean, it seems to me from what you just said that you may have some proctor showing up someplace and saying, did we make the 4.5 hours? Or somebody certifying that 4.5 hours of instruction was given in class ABC?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, actually what we do once a year, we have one of our three server education folks go and actually take a look at everybody's class. And so when they do that, they make sure that they are following the curriculum. They make sure that it's 4.5 hours and that kind of thing. That's as far as we go. We oversee the curriculum and we develop the curriculum. But we don't oversee the proctoring or any of that, and we do no training. So the training's done by the Restaurant Association, by other providers, by other instructors. So we're really the oversight.
But you've got somebody that shows up and checks a class at some point in time.
That's correct, Representative Johnson.
I guess I'm beating this to death, but I'm going to run that risk. It seems to me that if you're doing business with community colleges that are reputable purveyors of instructional services, that a certification from them that everyone attending the class had been there for the required 4.5 hours, which still just astonishes me, ought to suffice.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that probably would suffice from community colleges, but a number of our instructors are independent instructors, and they're not connected with any necessarily educational facility. They have their businesses that actually are simply training, and they're not connected with libraries or community colleges or anything like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if I could just elaborate on a little bit. I think one of the concerns when it started is kind of statewide consistency and to make sure that the adequate instruction is happening and the same information is given to all servers across the board and to maintain some consistency with the curriculum and what's being taught correctly. So you make some good points, though.
Is there a direct cost in that oversight? How much is the direct cost in that oversight?
Mr. Chair, a budget for we have currently four positions in server education that oversee.
But those are all positions that are funded from that fee, are they not?
Right.
Okay, so there's no general fund cost to continue doing what you're doing.
Mr. Chair, it's kind of hard. It was hard for me to understand. Yes, there's no general funds, except that our budget limitation has to include server education. So even though we bring in X amount of money based on our budget limitation and general from our budget, we can't spend all of it.
Mr. Chair, let me ask a question. Of the fee that the server pays to for both the cost of instruction, how much of that goes to OLCC, if any, when they're taking the test?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters and Satish may want to help you on this one, but there's about $13 of the fee that goes to the server education, is dedicated to server education.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the fee that is paid to the provider is purely to the provider.
Okay.
When they need to get their
permit,
then they send in the $23.
Okay. So it's the $23 that goes into.
There's $13 of that that goes into specifically the server education budget.
And the other $10?
That's part of our license fee.
Okay, so you have one, the oversight, and the other part of the license fee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's correct.
Okay.
Please proceed, Linda.
Reverend Johnson, you and I may want to get together.
Yeah, I think we'll need to get together with Linda and get some additional information here. I'd like to see how that all sorts out in a budget standpoint.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, excuse me, I'm sorry I misunderstood your question. Okay. On the compliance side, we ensure compliance with liquor laws. We believe that licensees will most likely comply if they know it. So we spend a lot of time, and as I mentioned, the law orientation, but we have a lot of other written materials that we provide to the licensees. We provide in education classes whenever they're requested. Also, in the Portland area, we offer a free ID identification class for licensees. That happens twice a month. And also out in the field, whenever this is requested by licensees, our staff tries to meet their needs. We also provide any other special training they need. We provide communications. And one thing that we have developed that we started in December is we developed a newsletter for our licensees. And it's actually saving us money. We use this as a notification for our rule changes, which before, when we had a rule change, we were required to notify licensees of rule changes. So we sent out all these mailings every time we did a rule change. This way, the consolidated rule notification, any regulatory information that needs to go out to licensees. We've included some merchandising store information and general news from the committee. I've brought some samples of these if you'd like to look at them later.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may not have the answer to this today, and we're getting close to the end, so it's fine if you get it to us tomorrow. But through the 2 days of testimony that you've been here, I've heard about all the education that you provide to others. You encourage the agents, and you give them certain instructions about how their store ought to look and what kind of merchandise they ought to have. You do all this licensee education. You do server education. I'd like a little bit of a rundown about what kind of training your folks get, specifically in the customer service area. Given that you are advising others about customer relations, I'm curious about the ongoing training that sensitizes your folks to the fact that they're doing business with businesses, where time is important, where customer relations are important, where relationships in general are important. And I just would like to get some kind of idea of how you train your people to do business with business.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, and the question, we have in the last 5 years instigated a very formal training program for our regulatory specialists who are investigators and our licensed inspectors. We try very hard to instill to them a lot of things. Not only the law, but how to deal with customers and how to do education. Not everybody is an educator, and so we try to help them through mentoring, through coaching, through providing examples. And a lot of it's kind of on the job training. We do provide diversity training whenever possible to our staff. We try to provide some customer service, but I can bring you some more detailed information on our training program.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm just thinking about the exchange of letters that you and I had in the interim, and I think you're, and I appreciate it, very forthright admission that maybe your folks weren't as sensitive as they should have been about doing business with business. And I'm just trying to get a sense above and beyond how long do you go with somebody through a mentoring or a coaching program until you come to the conclusion that maybe they're just not suited for this kind of work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have extended our, through contract, our probationary period for our regulatory inspections in the last couple of years. It is now a whole year that they have to be probation, because in this job it's very difficult to, in 6 months or less, trying to evaluate somebody's ability, because it takes them about 3 to 4 months to even figure out the laws and understand the laws before we actually send them out and try to do the job on their own. We are trying very hard to manage this, and I remember the incident that you and I had a letter writing campaign against, and those things I use as learning tools for the people that are involved. We talk about it, we evaluate how this could be handled differently, and they learn a great deal from those experiences. Unfortunately, it causes some ramifications in the process.
Well, and last point, Mr. Chair, they have a learning experience, but it's paid for by the business. And I think I'm interested in having some feedback about how this coaching experience for one of your regulatory folks, the cost, both the direct cost and the indirect cost that it had to the business that was involved with it. And that's the sense that I'm trying to get.
Perhaps it's not just a training, but also a hiring mechanism as well as an ongoing training. And did you get to the bottom line of the hiring, Representative Johnson?
No, nor did I get to the point where I know what the turnover is in your regulatory section, and I'd be curious to know the profile of longevity of the employees there.
And what the qualifications are that they're hired under, how much retail experience and experience relative to education they've had on these particular subjects would be important, I would think.
Well, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that particularly in this environment where we're worried about business, recognizing the challenges that confront businesses at all levels through your operation, just some indication that the agency is sensitive to the impact of their work on folks that are trying to make a living and make payrolls.
Mr. Chair, Johnson will bring that back to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Linda, how far are you?
I'm almost, I can speak to this, let's see.
I would like to get to the agency responses from yesterday, but go ahead.
Okay, I can move along quickly. One of the things I would like to highlight is our biannual visit. This is something that we instigated about 4 years ago. It was really important to us to be able to be seen by our industry, not only as an enforcement person, but also as someone who can help them and educate them. And so we've been out there visiting all of our licensed premises, providing them training, our education, or just meeting and having a contact person. We conduct a lot of proactive programs, such as the minor decoy, adult decoy, you're driving with influence, or the DUI program, and a false identification program. I'd like to share with you just a few statistics. I won't read all of them, but some of them that highlight some of the work we've done. We issued over 450 criminal citations last year, over 802 administrative tickets. We conducted 14,000 observations on our licensed premises last year. We checked over 6,200 service permits. And we gave over 10,000 verbal instructions to our licensees. Last year, we conducted about 840 minor decoy operations and checked over 12,000 identifications of young people. Statewide, we have 24.5 full-time equivalent positions, and then we have an additional 9 inspectors who are in a statewide compliance team. just to give an overview of how, as you saw earlier, our license and premises have grown over the years. In 1990, there was about 313 licensed premises per inspector, and as of today, there's about 383. So the licensed premises have really grown over the years. We have 11 offices across the state, and I think you have a map in your... should have a map in your book of those offices. Our main offices are in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, and Bend, with satellite offices in Pendleton, Warrenton, Newport, Roseburg, North Bend, and Klamath Falls. And our balancing enforcement, our number one concern is underage drinking, and so we've tried to balance a lot of our activities and focusing not only on the licensees but on the minors and furnishers. And so we have conducted a lot of different programs, and we've chosen four that I'd like to highlight real quickly for you. One is a false ID program, which we go out actively looking for people who manufacture false ID, and we've been very successful in some of those cases of finding that and stopping the manufacture of false ID. We have an ID checking program that we help with licensees. We work with them side by side at their doors, helping the security and their personnel learn how to check ID and help them at large events. And this has been a very positive program in working with our licensees. We have school contact programs that we contact all our high schools, middle schools, and provide classes when they ask for them, presentations. But also, just recently, what's interesting, two of the high schools in Portland asked us to help them at one of their winter, a couple of the winter balls. And so we were there to help them kind of monitor students as they were going into.
Senator Johnson?
Is that a fee for service?
Chairman, no, Representative Johnson, no, there's no fee for that.
It's laudable that a high school would be concerned about underage drinking. I think everybody in the whole building is concerned about underage drinking. But the question that I have is, at what point do you look at that as an isolated incident, or at what point do you look at that as a fee for service that you would provide? I mean, if every high school asks you to do that, at some point you've got personnel that are on overtime, I presume, or on comp time.
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, no, they're not on overtime. It's part of their regular duties. And yes, if it becomes something, what we're using it as a training tool for them. They asked us to come to kind of help them learn what they should be looking for. We're hoping that, you know, they'll eventually be able to do this on their own. I think what also is a message to the students that are trying to get to them, that if you're going to drink alcohol, you can't participate in a school activity. So for right now, we are not paying overtime or comp time as part of their regular duties.
Just one number that I wanted to get to, Linda, that on your page 11, your compliance activities for 2002, 14,067 observations mm-hmm. on licensed premises conducted. That's on approximately 8,000 licensed premises. Is that correct?
Chairman Butler, it depends. Sometimes the way that this is counted, and this is purely inspector stats, that may be they've gone back three or four times to the same place. So it's not going
there
to...
But there are 8,000-plus licensees.
Right.
Correct.
And this is a separate number than our premises visits.
Oh, okay.
Our premises visits are separate from this particular observation.
Service permits check, that's a different... I guess I was looking at some of the statistics that you get a higher compliance rate the more inspections that are actually made on those premises, and that's why I was just trying to determine what kind of compliance rate we were trying to seek as we visit those. Other questions for Ms. Ignowski?
I'm moving really fast.
Yes, you are. Go ahead. Continue on. That's the last page that I have of your testimony, other than the authority to add some overtime for University of Oregon and Oregon State University.
Okay, I just would like to get to real quickly.
Please.
Ms. Gregory mentioned simplifying the licensing process, and this has been an ongoing process since 1997. And if you've been a licensee, you'll see that our process has changed a great deal, hopefully. And I brought a sample of our license application, and it's simply buried in here.
It's that big book.
We developed a license application guide, and this is also on our website, and it walks licenses through how to apply for a license, and this has been a project that we worked on and completed that. And then our licensing forms have greatly decreased. Have been simplified, they're more legible, they're a little bit easier to read, so we're proud of what we've done here. We have some ways to go with that, but this is also available on our website, so our licensees can pull this down. So we have done a lot in changing
the chair. I'll take a look at it and I'll advise if it's a lot simpler than when I went through the process.
Okay. I just had one question in that regard. It looked like there's some financial information on the front of that. Do we have licensees that are going out of business on a regular basis?
Chairman Butler, we haven't seen that. It's incredible. In the last 2 years, where the economic downturn of our state has been going downward, our licensing actions are going up.
But I mean, the licensees themselves are not going upside down.
Chairman Butler, I think some are. I think what's happening, we're seeing a lot of change of ownership. People are getting out of the business.
How about amongst our liquor agents, the compensated agents themselves, 134 agents?
Mr. Chairman, our typical turnover for liquor agents is about 10% a year.
Okay. Any of those are declaring bankruptcy or?
Mr. Chairman, most of those are retirements.
Retirements, okay.
We did have one just recently who did leave the system who was not bankrupt.
But was insolvent or could have been insolvent.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
But that was actually due to another problem.
Okay.
So, and saving time, I won't go over all the other licensing simplification because you do have that in your book. I did want to mention this as an accomplishment last year. We worked with the Department of Human Services, and using the grant money from the U.S. Department of Office of Juvenile Justice Prevention, we developed a video that's a training video for all package stores of checking ID and selling to those being intoxicated people. I brought one for each one of you if you'd like to take one and look at it. We also produce it in Korean, so that I have a Korean one if anybody wants to see that one, too. But it is all in Korean. But we've made a concerted effort to try to get these out to our licensees, all of our package stores. When we issue a person a license now, we give them a training video so they can use it.
Not in Spanish, but in Korean?
We haven't got to the Spanish yet. If you'll notice that we have seen a lot of our, a majority of our package store owners are Korean, rather than our Hispanics are mainly in probably your restaurants. So we can do that if it's necessary, but we had the funds to do it in Korean, so we did get it done.
Yeah, we've gone through the issue of Korean ownership of package stores, but I guess servers and those kinds of things, I'm interested why it wouldn't be in Spanish.
Chairman Butler, just probably money wise, we had enough money to do it for the two, and time wise.
Okay. Let's see. We do have Linda. Are you finished?
No, I can be finished. It's all here in your packet if you choose to read it.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do have the list of responses from Karen from yesterday's inquiries.
Mr. Chair.
I beg your pardon. Senator Devlin's recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I was just getting in line first for the responses. So.
Okay.
The compliance check data sheet is part of the response. One of the things that's been pointed out in the testimony here today is that one of the highest objectives of the commission is to control underage drinking. A casual perusal of this would indicate that you have the lowest testing rate in terms of all these jurisdictions that have been surveyed in terms of the number of licensees that are actually tested. Even if you up that to 1,000, which I think is part of the demonstration here, you'd still only be about 12 or 13% of licensees being tested. If it's one of the highest priorities of the commission, and obviously you're actually even cutting regulatory personnel, too, in the budget. How are you going to... You say that you can get up to maybe a 75% compliance rate with this additional testing. Why, other than just simply dollars, and maybe the answer is dollars, why don't you try for a higher testing rate than 12 or 13%?
Chairman,
if you thought you could get up to an 80% compliance rate by doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deborah, and when we got this, this is from the Pacific Institute of Research in Washington. And when we asked for this, we gave them what we had there. And yes, we are looking at this. It was a little surprising that we were the one of the lowest in providing. We have up to our, we have goals we set this year. We're trying to do a lot more this year. Compliance rate. Our goal should be 100% of compliance rate. And I think, you know, being realistically trying to set our goal in increments of trying to get to something that's reasonable. Why you see a fluctuation of our rate is that for the first few years when we were doing the decoy operations, we've concentrated a lot in the Portland metro area down the corridors. We have now reached out to all the rural areas and out to the different areas of Oregon and trying to go out to everywhere. We've even hit Ontario and Burns and those places. And so our compliance rate has gone up, as Ms. Gregory said earlier, that some places when the first time we've gone out, the sale rate was 75%. And so that skews our rate dramatically. Hopefully as we get up to this place on a regular basis, we'll see our compliance rate drastically increase, and hopefully, you know, we will definitely increase our goal, because our goal should be 100% compliance.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of when a licensee is actually found in violation, what sort of our penalty matrix for being found in violation, and how does it compare to other states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it depends, kind of a question. We have, in the last legislative session, they instituted the Responsible Vendor Program. So if you are part of the Responsible Vendor Program and maintain all the requirements, you have a reduced sanction schedule. If you are not part of that Responsible Vendor Program, then you are on a regular schedule as a progressive discipline. This, you know, first time out is 1650 or 7-day suspension, then it goes to 4950 or 10-day suspension, and it graduates to the fourth time you sell, could be a cancellation of your license. The Responsible Vendor Program is progressive. It's a lot lower, and there is no cancellation on that schedule. There's a suspension of the ability to sell licenses. So it kind of depends on which program you're in.
Final follow-up.
Yes, please follow up.
When you detect that there's been an unlawful sale to a minor, is both the establishment and the employee held responsible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, the person who sells, if it's in a package store, is cited criminally, and a licensee is cited administratively.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. We have that information before us, then, that came out as a result of the questions which we have. Any other questions on that?
Just a comment, because I was really surprised that our per capita consumption of distilled spirits in 1999 was higher than California and Texas and New York.
Texas is actually quite low,
yes,
per capita. I was amazed.
I was absolutely, you
down
know.
The Bible Belt, I guess.
Well, I mean, when I look at, you know, New York City, and I'm thinking, you know, getting on looking at 122, we're actually, on the licensed states, we would be mid-range, and we're at 6 on the controlled states of consumption.
Now take a look at Washington, D.C. on that schedule. Look at all those politicians.
Yeah. But, you know, well, and Nevada,
yeah,
with all the gambling. But I was very surprised to see that we were higher than California.
Yeah, to stay in Nevada, you got to drink a lot of that antifreeze.
Well, a giveaway.
Oh, okay. That's right. That's
probably right. It's a giveaway. It's an enticer.
Okay. With that, we are a little behind schedule, but we'll go ahead and take this up at the end of our tomorrow. Thank you very much.